United States against Bustamante.
Good morning. This is really...
Mr. Cohn.
Yes. I'll start when Your Honor's tell me. I only have 2 minutes at the beginning, so...
I've just called your case.
Okay. This is really two cases. My case is very different from everybody else's case in this matter. It's real simple. The defendant was arrested. The defendant was in custody. The defendant invoked his constitutional rights to a lawyer. That was honored. What happened is the authorities came and questioned him, obtained his consent to search a car that was outside. It's very clear under the Supreme Court opinion of Innis that the authorities are not supposed to do anything to interrogate him after he requests an attorney. That's any words or actions or parts of the police that the police should know are likely to or cause to elicit an incriminating response from the suspect. The state takes the position that we must look at not what they're prohibited from doing, but what they obtain. They're saying is if what we obtain is a consent to search that's not an incriminating statement, and therefore it doesn't make a difference that the authorities are doing what they are prohibited from doing. It's wrong. First of all, the cases they cite are distinguishable in some extent because some of them do not involve...
Owen, do you have any response to United States against Pontanet, which holds that Miranda never authorizes the suppression of physical evidence?
Yes, Your Honor. My response to that is that it's not the authorization of physical evidence, it's the fact that he consented, and it's the act of consent...
But your motion is to suppress physical evidence. You're not moving to suppress a statement of consent. You're moving to suppress the fruits of something.
That is correct.
Pontanet holds, as a matter of law, that Miranda never authorizes the suppression of physical fruits.
The issue here, though, is that by requesting the consent... They are requesting an admission. You cannot request a consent to what? It's an admission that he's related to the car. That is...
Was that introduced into evidence?
Nothing was introduced in evidence. This was a...
Look, if there were a proposal to suppress his statement, I consent, as an implicit confession that this is my
car,
that might be a very interesting Miranda argument. But the motion was to suppress what was found in the search.
That is correct. Because
under Pontanet, that motion had to be denied,
even though
it might be that you could have filed a different motion that would have been granted.
Pontanet hadn't been decided. In fact, what had been decided is the district court opinion in Pontanet, not the Supreme Court opinion.
I don't understand the significance of that. Several circuits had held that Miranda extends to physical fruits. Indeed, that's why the case is captioned United States against Pontanet. They had lost in the Court of Appeals, and the Supreme Court reversed.
I stand in my position.
Thank you, Mr. Cohn. Ms. Cruz. Mr. Cohn, you should sit at counsel table.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Sherman Cruz, and I'm here on behalf of Defendant Appellant Rafael Pena. Your Honor, this is a case in which a man has gone to prison supposedly for being involved in a conspiracy that he was demonstrably and explicitly excluded from joining. And it is a case in which a man has been sentenced to life in prison for supposedly foreseeing 150 kilograms of cocaine that he was repeatedly told did not exist. I'm not here, Your Honor, to deny the possibility that Mr. Pena may have purchased drugs from Mr. Corral, but that's not what he was charged with. He was charged with conspiracy, and not just with He wasn't just charged with conspiracy with Mr. Corral, but with Mr. Corral and all of the other individuals named on his indictment. And, Your Honor, what the government was able to do by bringing this conspiracy charge was to introduce evidence at trial that didn't relate to Mr. Pena, but that nevertheless had an impact on the verdict as well as the sentence, and was able ultimately to increase the sentence purely as a result of the conspiracy charge. For instance, 50 kilograms of cocaine that Mr. Corral was arrested with was introduced at trial, even though the testimony was he had nothing to do with it, it wasn't intended for him, he wasn't going to get any of it, and he didn't know about it. In addition, alleged wrongful acts of his co-defendants were introduced at trial, for instance, serving as a lookout for Corral or storing drugs for Corral. These were allegations that weren't even made of Mr. Pena. But these, along with the gang-related evidence that was introduced at trial and that had an impact on sentencing, severely prejudiced Mr. Pena. Whereas when you take them out, when you only look at the hard evidence, Your Honor, we see that Mr. Pena didn't agree to a conspiracy at all with anyone.
Counsel, what? I'm not sure I understand your argument. We're not going to make an independent decision. We're reviewing the district judge's decision. Are you saying the district judge's decision was clearly erroneous? And if so, why?
Yes, Your Honor. I'm saying there was no reasonable basis for the jury to have found Mr. Pena guilty of a conspiracy, that the most that could have been found in this case was a buy-sell, which is not what he was charged with. The evidence in this case, which is over 5,000 wiretapped conversations, months of government surveillance, Mr. Corral's own testimony, the arrest of tens of defendants, multiple indictments that came down, and yet there's no evidence that Mr. Pena ever did anything than approach Mr. Corral for the occasional purchase of narcotics. He never broke down drugs. He never stored any cocaine. He never served as a lookout. He never referred any buyers. Mr. Corral never trusted him, in fact, lied to him repeatedly regarding the supply of drugs, never tried to cultivate him as a buyer, never made any serious attempts to refer him to other suppliers. There was no mutuality or exclusivity or cooperation between the two. And conspiracy law, Your Honor, requires that the two conspirators be mutually dependent on one another, that they render mutual support to one another. This is U.S. versus Townsend. There must be something more than the agreement to buy and sell drugs, and that's something more, that joint stake that must be there.
There have to be something more
than the agreement.
What we held in Lashuga is that all that's required for conspiracy is an agreement to commit a future crime. Now, there's always the question whether today's crime implies an agreement to commit a future crime. But there doesn't have to be anything more. And in fact, the Supreme Court has held there doesn't even have to be an overt act.
Yes, Your Honor, but that agreement did not exist in this case. There was no agreement to do anything other than to buy or sell drugs, and the agreement must be something more than the purchase of drugs itself. It must be some additional overt act. It must be an agreement to do an additional criminal activity other than the mere buy-sell relationship. Everything that Mr. Pena was trying to do in this case was just to purchase the drugs.
Do you believe that the district court relied just on that one phone call to tie to tie Mr. Pena to the larger conspiracy?
I believe there was scant evidence in that regard. I believe the phone call that you might be referring to is the one that he made to Mr. Corral while he was in the car.
Yes.
Mr. Corral said that he asked for drugs. He said he didn't have any. He didn't make any attempts to supply Mr. Pena on his own. Mr. Pena, not referring to any specific individuals, just sort of said, well, do you know of anybody who might have any? Corral turned around to the people that were in the back of the car and said, do you guys have any? And Aguirre said, no. In fact, actually, Mr. Greer did have narcotics, as was later revealed in his plea agreement. So all this shows is that there's multiple members of this agreement, of this conspiracy, that are refusing to provide supplies to Mr. Pena and that are keeping him in the dark regarding the supplies.
Well, I'm concerned about Pena's sentencing, so I want to make it clear to you where I'm coming from. It's my understanding the district court relied on that conversation as being enough to tie him to a larger conspiracy.
Yes. Even in that conversation, Your Honor, Mr. Pena was seeking a quarter kilogram of cocaine. What he was ultimately held to have been responsible for is over 600 times the amount that in that conversation he was twice told didn't exist.
Now, you had a were you at the sentencing in this case?
Your Honor, I've been appointed counsel at the appeal.
Well, as I understand it, the sentencing, there's a dispute about the ledger found in Pena's home.
Yes, Your Honor. The ledger, it's actually an interesting issue. The ledger, which didn't have any fingerprints on it, and there was no handwriting analysis done on the ledger, which may have revealed who was keeping it, had no date on it, so there was no indication as to whether it was kept in the course of this conspiracy, had no had nothing related to cocaine sales in it, although there was some evidence that it might have been tracing drug sales. Detective Weinkeck actually testified that it didn't necessarily relate to cocaine sales. There was nothing in there to indicate that.
Is your reading of the sentencing transcript that that the district court ever resolved that issue?
Actually, no, Your Honor. I think the district court was sort of ignoring a lot of the complications that came along with that issue. I understand it was the government's position what the ledger showed, but I think the defense actually did a good job of showing the opposite. In addition to the fact, Your Honor, that although Mr. Pena was charged to have entered into a Latin King conspiracy, at some point it became clear that that's not what was going on here. There was a tremendous amount of evidence offered both at trial and at sentencing that, in fact, Corral's activities were not part of the Latin Kings. He distributed more drugs outside the Latin Kings than inside the Latin Kings. And if it is now going to be the government's position that he should only be accountable for the Latin Kings drugs, then the government should agree that the over 90 kilograms of drugs that were attributed to him for members outside of the Latin Kings should be taken away.
Let me ask you about the gun enhancement. Now, the district court enhanced Pena's sentence on the gun found in his home, right?
Actually, it was in his girlfriend's home.
I'm just asking you, did the district court enhance?
Yes.
I don't want to get into the dispute. Well, then it also, Pena received, by way of the district court's action, 120 months on count 12 for the exact conduct, right?
Yes.
So do you view that as a double counting?
Yes, Your Honor. He was twice enhanced. Well, first of all, the initial enhancement to his conspiracy conviction should be reversed for two reasons. First, because of the double enhancement that took place. Second, because there was insufficient evidence that he possessed or had any control or dominion over this weapon. I see my time has run out.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Daisy.
Thank you, Your Honor. Bill Daisy for Steve Lascano. I had hope in 2 minutes to point out to the court that Mr. Lascano made or joined in arguments we expect to be addressed by other counsel.
Stand square in front of the podium. We'll make sure we've got you recorded so the entire Internet can hear your golden words later today.
I'm so pleased. Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Lascano is serving a life sentence that was a minimum sentence because of two Section 851 predicate convictions that he suffered. The only issue raised unique to Mr. Lascano is an effort to keep an Almendarez-Torres claim alive while this case is pending and hope that lightning strikes Almendarez-Torres and some other cases while this case is pending. My suggestion as to the
mission accomplished.
Thank you, Your Honor. As to the sufficiency of the evidence argument, variance, and buy-sell arguments made on behalf of Mr. Lascano. I would hope that the brief adequately addressed the argument on behalf of the defendant, and I suggest that the United States has adequately responded. There were four areas of evidence that the United States focused on in indicating or in justifying a jury conclusion that a conspiracy existed in which Mr. Lascano played a part. We've argued that each individually amounts to zero and that the sum of those factors still remains zero. I thank the court for its attention in this regard. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Bailey.
May it please the court, Victoria Bailey for Abraham S. Jamira. I'd like to use my time this morning to speak with the court about the wiretap issue, what we've been calling in our small circle the Cunningham issue. At the trial, Agent Sutphin testified regarding the procedures used to obtain a wiretap in this case. She discussed at some length the approval procedures used through the Department of Justice to obtain that wiretap, and then discussed the procedures used by the court to continue the wiretap, the 10-day report. No objection was made by any of the defendants at trial. And while this case was pending on appeal, this court issued its opinion in United States versus Cunningham. It's a case from the Southern District of Indiana in which the court held that it was error for the trial court to have allowed the admission of evidence, similar evidence, regarding wiretap proceedings in that case. And that case was reversed, remanded for a new trial for those defendants. It's our position that while there are distinctions between the evidence admitted in Estramira's, in this case, versus the evidence that was admitted in Cunningham, that the same principles apply. It was improper bolstering of the government's case. It served to relieve the government of its burden of proof. Specifically, what happened by the testimony regarding the agents in the Department of Justice and the use of the trial court to approve the wiretap was that the jury was left with the impression that there were government officials out there, unnamed government officials, who believed that the wiretaps were, or that the people being sought to have their phones tapped were committing crimes, and that the trial judge, when presented with that evidence, also believed that crimes were being committed. So the jury could believe that because all these other people believed these defendants were committing criminal acts, that they too should believe that that these defendants were committing criminal acts. And we believe it was plain error. We understand that this court will review our claim under a plain error standard because there was no objection. However, it was clearly an error. The error did affect the substantial rights of the defendant, specifically their right to have the government prove its case beyond a reasonable doubt. The government has no right to have its case proven by unnamed government officials and what they thought about the evidence that was being presented.
Introduction of the information about seeking the wiretap be plain error when the results of the wiretap are in evidence and rather highly inculpatory?
Well, there's a difference between the fact of the wiretap, that there was a wiretap and what was said on it. That speaks for itself. What doesn't speak for itself and where the error was the evidence presented to the jury that these unnamed government officials...
I understand. That's the holding of Cunningham. But plain error inquiry really requires proof that a miscarriage of justice has occurred. And it's hard to see the miscarriage of justice where what the jurors learned is that the federal agents suspected they would find exactly what the jury learned that they did find. That is, the defendants were talking about drugs over the phone.
That's correct, Your Honor. The reason it is plain error, and the reason that the admission of this evidence constitutes a miscarriage of justice... I see that my time has expired. May I answer?
Please do.
The reason it constitutes a miscarriage of justice is because when you look at the combination of the evidence of how the wiretap was obtained and then how the judge continued to approve the evidence... What it says to the jury is, not only do these government officials believe that these people were committing crimes, but the judge believes that the evidence gained from it was continuing to show criminal activity. That relieves the government of its burden to actually present evidence at trial of the criminal act. The evidence of the criminal act...
That's where I drop off, because you say it relieves them of the burden to present the evidence, but they did present the evidence.
And if they had only...
In quantity.
If they had only presented the evidence, the wiretap evidence itself, without the testimony of how they obtained it, this argument wouldn't be here.
Is your argument there's some sort of endorsement by reference to procedure in advance of admission?
Endorsement by...
Well, by the court, I guess. I mean,
yes.
Are you saying it's a heavier piece of evidence in some fashion because it's got this earlier procedural endorsement by the court?
It's improper bolstering of the government's case, Your Honor, because these people were not called to testify.
That's the problem. Bolstering of what? The jury learned that the judge thought that a wiretap would produce evidence of guilt, but of course jurors then learned that it did produce evidence of guilt.
But it was the jury's...
You see, here's my general problem, that the application for a wiretap shows that it is predicted that A will happen, Now, maybe the jury shouldn't learn that it has been predicted that A will happen. But then the jury learns that A did happen. And that's really the damning event.
But it was the jury's determination to make after hearing all the evidence that that's what the wiretaps showed. And they didn't have to make that decision because they were told that other people had already made that decision, i.e.
Where were they told they didn't have to make that decision?
That decision had already been made by the people at the Department of Justice and by the trial judge, Your Honor.
The wiretap had been decided, but whether the defendants were guilty. Well, anyway.
What's the difference between that and an indictment? Is that a running head start for the government?
No, because the jury specifically instructed in that instance that it's not to be considered as evidence of guilt. In this case, the jury received no such instruction.
But that's because you didn't ask.
Right.
That's why we're arguing under the plain error standard, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Egan.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'll turn first to the Cunningham issue. Here, there is a plain error standard.
Step up to the podium. We'll make sure you, too, are properly recorded.
Yes, Your Honor. There is a plain error standard of review here. The agent testimony in this case is distinguishable from that in the Cunningham case. While for the sake of this argument, we do concede that under Cunningham there is error and it's plain, it did not affect the defendant's substantial rights and did not affect the integrity of the proceedings. Here, it was a much more truncated version of testimony. There was a mention of it going to the Office of Enforcement Operations. There was not a lengthy colloquy on the review process either in the U.S. Attorney's Office or at the agency, and also there was not a great level of detailed discussion of what happened when it did go to...
Well, what was it supposed to accomplish? What was the reason for it?
Your Honor, while the reason for it is not necessarily within the record, I can speak to the fact that we did have the agent testify about that was to assure the jury that the government is not going around willy-nilly wiretapping people's phones without having to go through any procedures. And Your Honor, the government does recognize that that's precisely the reasoning that the court in Cunningham has rejected and has certainly called into question. And Your Honor, in addition, with respect...
Of course, it's not just wiretaps. You know, prosecutors in years past in this circuit have tried to have, please do not touch the microphones. If you need to lower the podium, use the switch.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Prosecutors have made a whole series of arguments that people can put in all sorts of incriminatory hearsay as an explanation of why we're investigating these people, this same kind of theory. We want to tell you that officials don't go around investigating just anybody. We really knew these guys were crooks when we started investigating them. And it's really just a smear tactic, which is why we've rejected it in Cunningham and elsewhere.
Yes, Your Honor, and the government certainly understands that. Here, however, this testimony was simply a drop in the bucket in compared to all the other evidence that the jury heard. It was not something that was referred to either in opening or in closing arguments, and therefore we believe that the defense has not shown that it was plain error to introduce this testimony. Turning to the sufficiency of the evidence argument with respect to...
I'm worried about time here, and Ms. Egan, I want to get to this Pena matter.
Yes, sir.
Because I'm concerned about the sentence here. Am I correct to understand that in holding Pena responsible for the drug amount in the entire conspiracy, the district court is relying on one phone conversation, the car conversation?
Your Honor, the government disagrees that Judge Holderman was simply relying on that one phone conversation.
Well, you tell me what else he was relying on from the sentencing transcript.
Your Honor, he did also take into account the fact that calls throughout the wiretap showed that Pena knew that Juan Corral had multiple shipments of cocaine coming in. He knew that others were involved in receiving that cocaine, and I believe that the court did rely also. Certainly the court pointed out very significantly to the call that Your Honor is referring to.
Right.
Absolutely. But also within the sentencing transcript and throughout the sentencing, the court made clear that Rafael Pena, because of his position, was not simply limited to what he himself was involved in. And that given his relationship with Corral, given the multiple conversations that they had, he was fully aware of the scope.
Well, what those multiple conversations, what do we have, what evidence do we have of what they were about? Unlike this conversation in the car, which clearly was about drugs.
Your Honor, there were conversations throughout the wiretap where Rafael Pena was talking to Juan Corral about when his next shipment was coming in, about whether he would be getting some of that shipment. And the court, Judge Holderman specifically, seemed to feel that those demonstrated that Rafael Pena did have knowledge of much more than...
Why is knowledge sufficient?
Suppose
there's an argument that General Motors has violated the environmental laws, and there's a prosecution against a General Motors dealer. Well, the dealer and General Motors plainly have a contract, right? It's a form of conspiracy. It's an agreement. The dealers know that General Motors is a really big organization. Does that make every dealer responsible for everything General Motors does?
No. However, knowledge is...
Why, then, if you concede that knowledge that General Motors is burying lead-based paint someplace doesn't make every dealer liable for everything General Motors does anywhere in the world, why is this different? I mean, in criminal lingo, this is a hub-and-spoke conspiracy, and Corral is the hub. Are all the spokes liable for everything they know the hub is doing?
No, because for all of the spokes, the full amount would not be foreseeable. However,
no, I'm not asking about foreseeability. Suppose the hub says, I'm the world's biggest drug dealer. There's no one in Colombia you can go to who has more stock than I do. Does that make every spoke liable for all the cocaine in Colombia?
No, it does not.
Presumably because it's not in furtherance of what the spoke is doing.
That's correct, Your Honor. And the government would also say that it would not be foreseeable to all of the spokes.
The hypothetical I have given you is one in which the hub says, I'm bigger than the biggest drug lord in Colombia. So there's no foreseeability problem. I've told you to assume foreseeability away. Is it your position that foreseeability is the only thing? Because if it were, you have to answer my General Motors hypothetical the other way. Why is it that you don't think that every GM dealer is liable for every pollution problem caused by General Motors everywhere in the world?
Because that's not the only, because knowledge is not the only element.
Right, foreseeability is not the be-all and end-all. So what else matters?
Your Honor, here, Rafael Pena was not merely a customer of Juan Corral. He was involved with Juan Corral. He was a Latin king. He was a member of the same gang as Juan Corral. He was the person in whose home the ledger was found that listed the members of the Latin king's gang, of which Juan Corral was one, as well as other members charged in this indictment. There was testimony at trial that the court heard that drug ledger related the dues that were owed to the gang. It pertained to the caja, which is the keeper of the funds of the gang. The gang is supported by drug dealing activities of the members of the gang. And money in that caja goes both to buy drugs as well as guns and for other matters. Therefore, it's that additional.
Normally interrupt counsel, but as you go on, you make it sound like that ledger, which is pretty damnable. I agree in the abstract, but the district court never resolves the factual issue of the ledger vis-a-vis Pena, right?
Your Honor, I don't recall that at sentencing the district court affirmatively said that it
right.
was taking the ledger into account. I believe that the court is correct on that.
Right.
However, the court had heard that testimony during the trial, as well as the testimony at sentencing, and it's the government's position that the district court took all of that into account prior to concluding that Defendant Pena was responsible.
What about the gun concern I raised with opposing counsel about whether there's some double counting? I mean, he's convicted on count 12, right? Felon
in
possession?
That's correct.
And he's also enhanced for the gun in another setting?
That's correct, Your Honor. The government believes that the district court did correctly calculate the guideline range. Under guideline section, I believe it's 3D1.2, those counts are to be grouped. Therefore, with the counts being grouped, the two-level gun enhancement would be taken into account and the resulting guideline added to the drug amount of level 38 for resulting level of 40, which resulted with his criminal history category in a guideline range of 360 to life. So we don't believe that there was any double counting that went into the calculation of the guideline
range.
Well,
note 4 to 2K2.4 seems to caution against what I think happened here, but perhaps I misread that.
Your Honor, in the alternatively, then Rafael Pena would not have been accountable at all for the fact that he had the gun. He would have been simply left with a level 38, which would effectively have negated the fact that he was found with a gun.
Thank you.
With respect to Defendant Bustamante's argument, the government believes that this is an issue that has been decided repeatedly, and we ask that you affirm.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Mr. Cohen, anything further?
Yes, sir.
Just so that you can be prepared, Ms. Cruz, your time had expired, but I'll give you a minute to respond with respect to the sentencing issues.
Responding on the decision of the U.S. Supreme Court, Your Honor, is related to is inappropriate in this case because the government never raised that issue. And as waiver is always, often, strictly applied to the defense, if you look at their brief, they never raised that issue. They never discussed that issue. And therefore, if this court is going to consider that issue, I should be permitted to file an additional brief. Otherwise,
do you have anything to say other than the fact that this is a slam dunk after Pontanet?
Oh, I think even Pontanet may be distinguishable, and therefore I would like an opportunity to respond to an issue. But I think that you should say, as you have often said, when the defense wants to raise something which was waived, sorry, folks, you didn't say it. Waiver applies to the government as well as it does to the state. And therefore, we go back to the issue that clearly what occurred here is in violation of the defendant's constitutional rights. And to look at anything which says that to ask about consent is not going to be the type of thing that might cause you to spill the beans is absolutely wrong and ridiculous.
Thank you, Mr. Cohen. We'll let you know if we think further briefing is required. Ms. Cruz.
Thank you, Your Honors. I greatly appreciate the additional minute. Just very quickly to respond to the government's arguments, it was stated that there was repeated phone calls in which Mr. Pena was asking Mr. Corral when his next shipment would be and whether he would be getting any of that. Mr. Corral repeatedly lied to Mr. Pena and told him that he wasn't receiving any shipments when in fact he was, which is of course evidence that Mr. Pena couldn't have reasonably foreseen the amount in the shipments. In addition, as Your Honor pointed out, there was no act taken in furtherance of this conspiracy. In fact, Mr. Corral's dealings with others hindered Mr. Pena's individual objectives because he preferred to sell to others in lieu of selling to him. As far as the ledger was concerned, as I mentioned earlier, Detective Weinkeck's testimony, which can be found in our joint appendix, page 228, said that it had nothing to do with cocaine sales. There's no evidence that it related to cocaine sales. The membership dues of the gangs, Your Honor, were $20 a month, and they also went to support neighborhood picnics. So in terms of this being sufficient evidence to hold Mr. Pena, who, by the way, was never proved to have been the person who kept the ledger, liable for 150 kilograms of the conspiracy is quite far-fetched. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Counsel, several of you were appointed. I will try to piece this out. We thank you very much for your willingness to accept the representation and the assistance you've been to both your clients and the court. The case is taken under advisement.